These are men, troopers, valuable soldiers. They could live to fight again, to turn another conflict for the better. Leave me to care for them, with whoever you can spare. Leave me, and come back for us all. Gaunt cursed.
I'll give you a squad. I can spare no more. 10 men, volunteers. If it doesn't come to 10, tough. Muller will have my head for leaving any in the field as it is.
I'll take whatever I can get, Dawden said. Thank you.
Gaunt strode away abruptly, then turned, came back and took Dawden's hand tightly in his own. You're a brave man. Don't let them take you alive. And don't make me regret allowing you to be too brave. Gaunt and the retreating lines of ghosts passed on, and then they were alone. Dawden was working in the long hall, and only noticed the passing of time as the sunshine through the skylights faded to blue, and dusk fell. He lit lamps on crates placed between the wounded, and went outside into the yard. Overhead, alien stars were coming out in the mauve sky. He saw 3 ghosts at first, Lesp, Chaker, and Foskin, who acted as his orderlies and were skilled field medics. They were sorting through the medical supplies Gaunt had left for them. Dawden had half expected them to volunteer and stay, hoped for it, but to see his 3 staffers working as usual was refreshing and uplifting. He crossed to them, meaning to carry on as normal and ask about the supply level, but all he found in his throat was thanks. Each one smiled, took his hand as he offered it, grunted an acknowledgement of duty. Dawden was proud of them. He started to give them dispersal instructions, and began to run through the needs of the sick in priority order, when other ghosts stepped into view. McColl, the chief scout and Dawden's closest friend in the unit, accompanied by troopers Brostin, Clegg, Caffran, and Goots. They had just finished a patrol sweep of the horseshoe boundary and were preparing to dig in for the night. Dawden greeted McColl.
You needn't have stayed.
And leave you alone here, McColl laughed. I'll not have the record say Medic Dawden died, and where was his friend the warrior McColl? The commissar asked for volunteers, and so we volunteered.
I'll not forget this, however short my life, Dawden replied.
We have the flank guarded well, McColl told Dawden, indicating the double fence. All 10 of us.
10?
That's what the Colonel Commissar allowed. Us 5, your 3, and the other 2. All of the ghosts were arguing over who could stay, did you know? Everyone volunteered for the duty.
Everyone? Not Major Ron, I'd bet.
McColl grinned ruefully. All right, not everyone. But there was a scramble for places. Gaunt finally decided on first come, first served. So you got your 3, me, Brostin, Clegg, Caffran, and Goots, plus Tremard on watch at the gates, and?
Dawden whipped round, sensing someone was suddenly behind him. He looked up into the smiling bearded face of Colm Corbeck.
And me? So, Doc, you're in charge. How do we play this?
Night fell. The air cleared. Distantly, carrion dogs howled. 3 or more moons rose and set, dueling with each other's orbits. The darkness was clear and cold, and smelled of death. Far away, on the southern horizon, amber clouds thumped and boiled, a storm approaching. A mighty land army was moving towards them. That, and a real storm. Lightning shuddered the skies in hazes of white flash. The air became heavy and sweet. Inside the farmhouse, one of the blue bloods spasmed and died. Dawden was fighting for that life, his apron smock slick with spurting blood. There was nothing he or Lesp could do. Dawden stepped back from the cooling corpse and handed bloodied instruments to Lesp.
Record time and manner of death, and the name and number from the tags, he said darkly. Emperor willing, we can pass it to the Volponi adjutant's office, and they can adjust their records.
Lesp snorted.
The Blue Bloods have doubtless marked all these as dead already.
Lesp was a tall, thin man from Tanith Longshore, with cold blue eyes and an Adam's apple that looked like a knee in his slender neck. He'd been a fisherman back on the Lost Place, part of a sea-fishing family which plied the ocean currents beyond the archipelago. He owned a fierce skill with a sailcloth and net needle, and an almost surgical knack with a blade learned from gutting fish back in those days. Dawdon had put those skills to use in the name of healing when he had co-opted Lesp as an orderly. Lesp had taken to it well and enjoyed his work alongside the chief medic. Dawdon took all the willing, able help he could get. Most of the trained medics who had founded with the ghosts on Tanith had never made it off-world. Originally, the only fully qualified medics had been Dawdon, Geran, and Matane, with 20 other troopers trained as field medics. Dawdon had interviewed and studied all of the surviving men to recruit for the badly needed medical staff. Without devoted, constantly learning amateurs like Lesp, Foskin, and Chaker, the health of the regiment would have failed long ago. Matane and Geran had moved on with Gaunt's main force, though both had wanted to stay. Losing all three trained medics in one rash act was more than Gaunt would tolerate. Dawdon stepped out into the muddy yard and, as if on cue, the heavens opened and sheeting rain hammered down on him, washing another's blood out of his tunic. He stood there, dripping, as the downpour eased a little. "You'll get wet out there," came a voice from nearby. Dawdon swung round to face Corbeck, who was smoking a cigar in the cover of the slumping side roof. All Dawdon could see was the shape and the red coal of the light. Dawdon crossed to him. Corbeck offered up a waxy box of smokes. "Licorice. Got the taste of them on Voltamand, and it's taken me an age to get some on the black market. Take one for now, and one for later." Dawdon took two, slid one behind his ear unlit, and lit up the other from Corbeck's half-smoked stick. They looked out into the night. "It's going to be rough," remarked Corbeck, softly. He was looking at the flash and howl of the storm, but Dawdon knew what he meant. "Yet you stayed?" Corbeck took a deep drag, and white smoke plumed out of his hairy shadow. "I'm a sucker for good deeds. Or lost causes. The Emperor will provide. And aren't we all just one big lost cause? The first and last, and lost. You don't see me giving up on that." Dawdon smiled. The cigar was strong, and the flavor hellish, but he was enjoying it. It had been 20 years since he'd smoked. His wife had never approved, said it didn't set a good example to the patients Dawdon tended to. Then the kids came along, Michael and Clara, and he'd kicked the habit, so Dawdon shut off the thoughts. Tanith had taken his wife with it, and Clara and her husband, and their baby, too. All he had was Michael, Trooper Michael Dawdon, Voxcaster operator in Sergeant Hasker's platoon. "You're thinking about home," Corbeck muttered. Dawdon broke his sad reverie.
"What?"
"I know that look."
"It's dark, Colonel."
"I know that feeling, then. The set of a man's shoulders. Comes on us all, time to time."
"I'd guess the Commissar has told you to stamp it out wherever you see it. Bad for morale?"
"Not in my book. Tanith still lives while we all carry it here." Corbeck tapped his forehead. "And we don't know where we're going if we don't know where we came from."
"Where are we going, do you suppose?"
Corbeck flicked his butt onto the mud and let it sputter dead.
"On a bad day, to hell. On a good day, I'd say we were bound for that trophy world Gaunt's promised us. Slado's gift. The first world we truly win, we can take and claim and settle as our own."
Dawdon gazed at the storm.
"New Tanith, huh? Like the men talk of when they're drunk or dying. Do you believe that? Might we ever take a world ourselves, get the credit clean and true? We're less than 2,000. Every theatre we enter, we do so alongside other regiments, and that muddies victory claims and credit. I'm not a pessimist, Colonel, but I doubt any of us will ever find that new Tanith, except in drink or death."
Corbeck smiled, his white teeth shining in the gloom.
"Then, lucky me. One way or another, I'll see more of it than most."
A door banged to their left. Chaker, shrouded in his cape, emerged from the hospital and carried a tin drum over to the well. A few moments cranking, and he struggled with it back to the buildings. Dawdon and Corbeck could already smell the broth Chaker and Foskin were brewing for all the company.
"Something smells good," Corbeck said.
"Foskin found tubers and grain in a field beyond the ditch walls, and we turned up dry pulses and salt meat in an old pantry. Should be the best supper any of us have had in a while. But first rations go to any of the patients who can take it.
Of course. They need it more than us. I've got a flask of sacra and a box of these smokes. Should keep me going a while.
Come in when you're ready for proper nourishment,
Norden instructed, as if issuing a prescription.
Thanks for the cigars.
He headed back to the ward. A circuit of the wounded took another hour and a half. Lesp and the other orderlies had done well, and many had eaten, or at least taken fluid. There were 12 who were too far gone to remain conscious, and Dawdon carefully rationed out his supply of drugs to prioritize them. The boy, Kulkis, along with a few others, were now sitting up, chatting, grateful. All of them, Volpone, Aristoblood, were disdainful of the Tanith, but civil, nevertheless. Being cut adrift by their regiment and spared from death only by a barbarian unit would seem to have altered many of their deeper prejudices and snobberies. For that, at least, Dawdon felt pleased. He saw Trooper Caffran coming in soaked from a patrol circuit, taking his bowl of broth to sit with Kulkis. They were about the same age, Dawdon reckoned. The same age as Michael. He heard them share a joke. Lesp took his arm. One of the critical cases was showing signs of fading. With Chaker's help, they carried the man out into what had once been the household kitchen, and now served as a surgical theatre. A refractory table sat there, long enough for a man, and they heaved him onto it. The blue blood, a corporal Regara by his tags, had lost a leg below the knee and taken shrapnel in the chest. His blood was far from blue. The refractory table became slick, and blood drooled off onto the flagstones. Chaker almost slipped, and Dawdon ordered him to fetch a mop and more wadding.
There are no mops, Chaker shrugged.
Then find something like a mop.
Dawdon had to take off more of the ruined leg from the shrieking Regara with his handsaw before he could staunch and tie the hemorrhage. He directed Lesp's sure fingers into suture the breach with fine sailmaker's stitches. By then, Chaker had returned. Dawdon found he was mopping the floor with shredded strips from his cape tied to an old rake handle. For a ghost to tear up his treasured stealth cloak to mop blood, Dawdon's admiration for his volunteer's devotion to duty grew. They carried the softly moaning Regara back to his bed. With luck and a fever-breaking shot of masketamine, he might yet live. But Dawdon was called away almost at once to a seizure that Foskin couldn't cope with, and then to a man who had woken from near coma only to begin violently retching blood. The ward fell quiet towards midnight, as other dramas came and passed. Dawdon was scrubbing his chrome rib spreaders in a bucket of scalding water when McColl came in, shaking the water from his cape. The storm was still booming outside, and thunder rattled the casements and roofing. Every now and then, loose glass in a window somewhere fell in, or tiles slipped off and shattered. The storm had continued all that evening, but until then, Dawdon had blanked it out. He watched McColl sit and clean his gun, the first thing he always did before seeing to other duties like food or warmth. Dawdon took him a bowl of broth.
Anything out there?
McColl shook his head.
If we're lucky, the storm is slowing their advance.
And if we're not?
They conjured the storm.
McColl looked up at the rafters and the high roof.
This must have been quite a place. A good homestead. Worth the working. The soil is healthy, and they had plenty of livestock.
A family home,
Dawdon pondered, who hadn't thought about it before. The thought of another home and family lost to the war now bittered him. He felt weary again. Old. McColl spooned his broth quietly.
There's an old chapel at the rear of the house. Blown in, of course, but you can still see the painted reredos commemorating the Emperor. The Volpone used it as a privy. Whoever lived here were devout servants of the Imperium, working the land, raising their kin.
Until this.
Dawdon fell silent. Chaos had taken this world. Nasadon, 2 months gone, as part of their counterpunch to thwart Makaroth's crusade. It hadn't been occupied or even corrupted from within. Nasadon, an agricultural world with 3 million imperial colonists, had been violated and invaded in the space of 3 nights. What kind of universe was it, Dawdon wondered, where humans could struggle and break their backs and love their families and worship the Emperor and build for years, only to lose it all in a few hours? His universe, he concluded. the same one that had taken Tanith away. A late moon was up, a lonely sentry in a sky suddenly clear of storm. The rain had stopped, and silver clouds scudded across the purple openness of the heaven. Counterpart to the moon, a lone sentry stood at the gate of the station. Trooper Tremard, sitting his second shift at the gate in the sandbag emplacement, watched the tree lines, black fuzzes of darkness, edging the flats of the equally black fields and fens. He was tired, and he wished that the Fething Volpone had left their heavy gun in the emplacement. Mist rose across the fenland, drifting sideways like smoke. Something twinkled in the dark. Tremard started up, grabbing his scope from the sandbags. He fumbled with the focus ring, pulling the green-on-green night vision view into true. Mist, and other things in it. The twinkle he had seen. Moonlight flashing back from the staring reflective retina of hunting eyes. He triggered his microbead link.
Gate to ghosts. Can you hear me, Kerner? Two arms! Two arms! Movement to the south!
Corbeck rose abruptly from his cot, like a dead man lifting from a grave, making Dawdon start. The colonel had been catching 40 winks on a spare bed in the ward as the medic sorted pills into paper twists.
What is it?
Corbeck was on his feet.
Three guesses, Doc.
Dawdon was up too. He looked around at the fragile hall, the vulnerable half-dead men, as Corbeck readied his lasgun and voxed in with the other troopers. Dawdon felt suddenly stupid. He knew what a full-on assault of chaos was like. They'd all be shattered like an eggshell. He'd been stupid to insist on staying. Now he had them all dead, the blue bloods, the ghosts, valuable, peerless ghosts like Corbeck and McColl. He'd wasted them all over some foolish pride in an old oath, an old medical oath, taken in safer times, in a nice community practice, where the worst injury was a laceration at the sawmill. Feth me for a fool. Feth me for my pride.
We'll front them as long as we can. The boys know some tricks, Corbeck told him. I'll need Chaker and Foskin. Lesp can stay with you. If we lose the first attack, you need to be ready to get as many of the wounded out into the back rooms. They're ruins, I know, but it'll put more walls between you and the fighting.
Dawdon swallowed, thinking of the work it would take him and Lesp to carry 67 men out into the rear of the dwelling on stretchers. He'd heard the distant wail of Lasfire and realized it wouldn't be half the effort Corbeck and his soldiers were about to make. So he simply nodded, beckoning Lesp to him.
Emperor be with you and watch over you, Colum Corbeck, he said.
And you, Doc.
Tremard held the gate. Dark shapes moved across the fields and through the dim hedgerows towards him, crackling out green pulses of laser fire and white-hot bolt rounds. The treacherous moon showed movement and the occasional glint of armor, and he picked his targets well, barking orange slices of laser into the open fenland beyond the farm. Ducking the incoming sprays of fire, a figure dropped into the position beside him. It was Colonel Corbeck. Corbeck grinned at Tremard, made some obscene remark as to the maternal origins of the enemy that had Tremard cackling at its vulgarity, and leaned up over the bags to loose a volley of shots from his lasgun down the lane into the fens. Along the ditch walls, the other ghosts opened up. Eight lasguns against the encroaching dark, eight lasguns picking their targets through scope and skill, matching the hundreds of fire points blasting back at them from the fens.
Where's Broston?
Corbeck barked into his microbead, over the howl of gunplay, sustaining a regular fire pattern. A second later, his query was lost in a withering assault, which blasted down the lane and onto his position. 100 or more warriors of chaos were forcing their approach at the main gate, charging them, weapons blazing. Corbeck and Tremard could see nothing but the light blur of their guns. Corbeck ducked under the intense volley. He didn't even curse. It was over, he knew. The end of Colum Corbeck. By his side, Tremard, a second too late in ducking, flew backwards, his left arm gone in a shredded waste of flesh below the shoulder. He fell on his back, screaming and writhing. His lasgun, with his left hand still holding the grip, sat miraculously on the parapet where he had rested it. Corbeck scrambled to him, under the hideous rain of bolt and lasfire, grabbing the struggling man and holding him close. He had to calm him and make him still before he could tie up that awful stump, if he lived that long. Tremard screamed and screamed, fighting like a scalded cat, drenching Corbeck and himself with the pumping arterial spray of his stump. Corbeck glanced up to see black forms in quilted armor faces covered by gas hoods, scrambling over the lip of the sandbags towards him. He could smell their rank animal scent, and the badges of the dark gods blazoned on their armor burned in his mind, even at a glimpse, and turned his stomach. There was a double click, dry and solid, and then a whoosh of heat as the night lit up. Korbeck winced. Trooper Brostin stood over him, raking the tops of the sandbags and the lane beyond with his flamer. The hurricane force of the flame gout cut the enemy away like dry grass.
"I was wondering where you'd got to," Korbeck said to Brostin. Then he tapped his microbead. "Medic! Medic!"
Dorden and Lesp were halfway through transporting the injured into the rear of the house when the call came through. Stray shots were punching through the ward hall, exploding rafters and shattering wall plaster and brick. Dorden fumbled with his microbead, trying to steady the stretcher he was sharing with the backing Lesp.
"Dorden, what?"
"Chamard's down. Bad. Get out here."
Any more of Korbeck's message was lost in crackling static, drowned by the gunfire.
"Set it down. I'll drag it,"
Lesp cried to Dorden as a Lazaran punched a hole in the plaster near his head. Dorden did so, and Lesp hauled the stretcher through the archway, its wooden handles screeching on the floor.
"Just like a fish box back home,"
Lesp yelled over the onslaught as he disappeared. Dorden grabbed his kit.
"Korbeck, I'm coming out, but you need to send someone in to help Lesp move the wounded."
"Feth that, we're all engaged out here. Can't spare a man."
"Don't give me that,"
Dorden returned, scuttling under the puncture level of the Laz range as the hall fell apart around him.
"Lesp needs help. These men need help."
A hand took his shoulder. He looked round. It was the blue blood Kulkis. Several more of the less seriously injured Volponi were with him.
"I can't manage a stretcher with my leg, but I can man a firepoint, Doctor. I'll take any Laz gun free if it means able bodies can help you here."
Dorden smiled at the young man's bravery. Pain was slashed into the blue blood's thin face. He nodded them forward to the door, and they looked out into the rain of fire.
"Kafran," Dorden called on the link, "I'm sending a blue blood over to you. Give him your weapon, and then return."
He didn't wait for an answer. Using Chaker's mop as a crutch, Kulkis scurried out into the yard and made the inner wall, where Kafran was blasting through a fire slot. A nod, and Kafran gave up his gun and position to the blue blood. Kulkis settled in, leaning against the flakboards, and resumed blasting. Kafran ran back to the farmhouse door, where Dorden was waiting.
"Help Lesp! Go! Go!"
In 3 minutes, Dorden had substituted 3 more Volponis on the defense line, men with leg wounds or head wounds, but able-bodied. In return, he got Clegg, Gutz, and Foskin. Dorden told Foskin the drill, and Foskin supervised the 5 able-bodied ghosts into a slick pattern of removing the wounded into the rear sections of the house. Shaken by the onslaught which lit up the feeble night, Dorden reached the gatepost, running in a stoop. Brostin and Korbeck were blasting away. Brostin was now using Tremard's lasgun, switching to the big flamer every time the assault became too great. Dorden knelt by Tremard, assessed his injury, and set to work.
"I need a stretcher for him,"
Dorden yelled at Korbeck.
"Help him, Brostin,"
Korbeck snapped. As Dorden and Brostin carried Tremard back to the farmhouse, Korbeck held the gate. Dorden's last view of him was clear. The huge Tanith warrior, his hair loose and flowing in the night wind, as the storm came down again, crackling and flashing, flamer in one hand, lasgun in the other, dealing death to anything that moved. The enemy assault had pivoted to the western side of the horseshoe, and heavy fire slammed against the flakboarding, throwing some sheets up out of the muck and shattering them. McColl felt more than saw the change in emphasis and rushed from his position at the east end to support Chaker and a blue blood called Vengo, who had substituted for Gutz. Chaos soldiers were pushing through the holes in the outer flakboard wall, and the 3 guardsmen, firing single aimed shots to preserve power on Korbeck's orders, dropped dozens into the slime pit of the ditch. Soon, bodies blocked the fence holes as well as the missing boards had done. "Well enough when they come at us with bolt guns and las weapons," McColl thought to himself darkly. "But what do we do when they bring up flamers, melters, grenades, or worse?" The cacophony of the assault was ear-splitting, and a double echo rolled back to them from the wide fens like thunder, almost as loud as the real thing. The storm, or the storming, shook the earth, and McColl wasn't sure which. Vengo, bandaged up with a gut wound, found his strength failing and his vision swimming. The majesty and fury of the open assault, the desperation and the frantic effort, had quite numbed him to the dull pain of his injuries, but they were telling on him nonetheless. Drenched by the downpour, he tried to reposition himself, changing spent clip for fresh with cold, wet hands. The fresh power clip slipped away and dropped into the mud under his feet. He stooped. A soldier of chaos, cut down and presumed dead in the ditch, had crawled forward and now loomed over the inner fence above the scrabbling Volpone. His chest had been blasted open, and blood and tissue dribbled from exposed ribs. His gas hood was also gone, revealing the fanged snout and grey hide of his corrupted face. He swung up a rusty entrenching tool. Chaker, dazzled by the volleys of lazlight and the strobe effect of the lightning, saw his assailant in a flash of white, frozen mid-swing. He wrenched his lasgun out of the fire slot and blasted down the gully, blowing the attacker out over the fence. Rising with the recovered clip, deafened by the sensory overload of the storm and fighting, Vengo had no idea how he had been spared or how close he had been to death. Bolt rounds drummed into the flakboards around McColl's slot and nailed wooden splinters into his cheek and neck. He cried out and dropped back for a second. Rubbing at the bloody grazes in his face, he moved back to the slot, re-aiming. Other dark shapes were stirring in the filth at the bottom of the ditch. Vengo's close call had been a warning. Even killing shots didn't seem to finish all of these abominations. Many of those that they had cut down were far from dead, and now were crawling and clambering up to attack the inner fence. "Brace!" he yelled over the comlink to Chaker and Vengo. He had a few tube charges left, and he hefted three over the inner fence into the ditch with its half-seen stirrings. The triple blast rocked them and pelted the inner flakboards with liquid mud and liquefied organics. "Keep checking the ditch," McColl voxed. "They don't die easy." Vengo caught the hint at once and lowered his aim to pick off two more of the supposed dead who were writhing through the mire towards him. Others clustered around the breaches in the outer fence, cut down by the trap as fast as they gathered and pressed in. "How many of them are there out there?" Chaker wondered. The force of the assault seemed to be increasing with every moment. On the eastern turn of the horseshoe, Kulkis held the line with his other two Volpone substitutes, Drado and Spears. Brostin had returned from his stretcher run to the house and fell in beside Kulkis, hefting a misfiring Volpone heavy stubber he'd found leaning against the wall in the long hall. It had a drum of 60 rounds left in it, and he'd resolved to use them all before switching to his las pistol. His flamer was in Korbeck's meaty hands at the gate. All they could hear or see from the gate area at the southern point of the horseshoe were belches of flame and las chatter and Korbeck's increasingly colourful exclamations over the voxlink. Brostin settled in, getting to know the unfamiliar stubber. Its cyclic rate was poor, and it jammed frequently, but when it fired, the thump and blast was satisfying. He shredded half a dozen shapes that loomed beyond the outer fence. At the eastern side, the tree line and woods were closer than at the west, which looked out over fenland, interrupted only by hedges and dikes. Here, the enemy was on them with little warning, rushing out of the trees to assault the double fence and the ditch. Brostin found himself admiring the shooting skills of the blue blood Kulkis. Arrogantly, against Korbeck's orders, he had adjusted the power setting to full and was firing off searing orange blasts. But each one counted. "His eyes as good as Mad Larkin's," thought the heavy-set ghost, and that's a real compliment. Drado and Spears were doing their part too, but Drado's aim was off. Though able-bodied, the man had a head wound and one eye bandaged. The lack of binocular rangefinding was ruining his shot. Brostin hunkered down and moved along the fence to him.
"Aim left," he yelled over the barrage and the thunder. "You're shooting wide."
Drado turned on him, his noble half-bandaged face curled into a haughty sneer. "No low-life gutter dog tells a Volpone how to fight." Brostin smacked him hard with the side of his fist and slammed the blue blood into the mud.
"Get up,"
Brostin said fiercely, fist raised. "This is a last stand of the Tanith first and only. We're only here because of you and your kinsmen. Fight like a ghost or stand aside and let someone else do it." Drado hauled himself up and spat at Brostin.
"You'll pay," he began.
Firing his stubber out at the enemy, Brostin laughed.
"Pay? Of course I'll pay. But not to you. If we live through this, my blue blood friend, you can hammer me to hell and get your oh-so-noble brothers to help. See me care. If we don't die here tonight, guarding the line to protect your precious wounded, then I'll go laughing into any retribution you care to dish out. What could be worse than this?"
Drado didn't answer. he set to firing again, and Brostin noted with approval that he was compensating now and favoring the left side. He made hits.
"Much better, you fifth wit," he muttered.
Inside the manor house, Dorden checked the state of the wounded they had moved. With the help of Lesp, Goots, Caffran Foskin, and Clegg, he had transferred the patients back, one at a time, through to the rear chambers, and then down in the long undercroft. This low, vaulted cellar space was made of thick stone. The best protection they could afford. They might survive the attack here, or be buried like rats. With Foskin's help, he treated Tremard's wound and got him stable. Then he ordered all the ghosts back out to the defense, all except Lesp, whom he needed. Another comatose Volpone had woken during the rough relocation and was convulsing. Caffran, Foskin, Goots, and Clegg made their way up the cellar steps, taking their pick of the broken Volpone weapons stacked in the stable block on their way to rejoin the defense. The convulsing Volpone died, though he showed no outward signs of injury except severe bruising. Dorden knew his innards had been turned to jelly by artillery concussion. Lesp helped him haul the corpse back up the undercroft stairs and dump it in the hall. They went back down. The undercroft was damp and pungent, lit by hissing chemical lamps the ghosts had set up hurriedly. The injured moaned and sighed. Some slept like they were dead. The earth around them all shook, and trickles of liquid mud spurted down from the roof every now and then as the onslaught rattled the foundations of the house.
"We're all going to die here, aren't we, sir?" Lesp asked, his voice clear and certain.
Dorden stammered for a moment, lost for words. He thought, desperately, what Gaunt might say in such circumstances. What would a trained political officer do here, trying to raise the spirits of men looking death in the face? He couldn't do it. It wasn't in him. He couldn't compose any deft line about the greater good of the Imperial Guard or the lifeblood of the Emperor. Instead, all he could manage was something entirely personal.
"I'm not," he told Lesp. "When I die, my wife and daughter and granddaughter die too. Their memories lost with me. For them, I'll not die here, Lesp."
Lesp nodded, his big Adam's apple gulping in his narrow throat. He thought of the memories he carried. Mother, father, brothers, crewmates on the archipelago trawler.
"Neither will I then," he managed.
Dorden turned towards the stairs.
"Where are you going?" Lesp asked. "You manage things here. I'm going to take a look up top. From the sound of things, they may need a medic."
Lesp pulled out his las pistol and offered it, butt first, to the chief medic. Dorden shook his head.
"I can't start that, no," he said.
Upstairs, the old ruin was quiet. It seemed as if the storm and the assault had abated together for the moment. Dorden edged into the vacated long hall and tried his microbead, but it was dead. The ceiling lamps swung, and loose debris fluttered down. Free of bodies, the stinking cots looked pitiful and sadly spoiled. Dorden stepped over pools of blood and shreds of discarded clothing. He strode into the outer kitchen, looking once at the stained table where he had excised a part of Ragara's leg. He saw the old fireplace for the first time. Black iron, just like the one he had sat before at home on Tanith. He and his wife, at the end of a long night, with a book and a glass of something warming, before the great light. Along the mantel, small blocks of what looked like chalk sat in a row. He moved over and took one in his hand. A tusk. The small, shed tusk of a pig. The inhabitants of this manor, whoever they were, had raised swine, cared for them enough to treasure the trophies of their growth and development. Pig teeth, each marked in a delicate hand with a name. Emperor, sire, his lordship, and dates. This touch of frugal humanity, the day-to-day chronicle of a farmstead, affected him deeply. It wasn't mawkish. It mattered somehow. Why pigs? Who had lived here? Raised the swine, toiled in the fens, brought up a family. A sound from the long hall brought him up to the surface of his thoughts. He moved back to meet a gaggle of men as they limped and blundered in through the hall doors from the outside. The Volpone substitutes and the ghosts, all except Corbeck. They were shell-shocked and dazed, weary on their feet. Dorden found McColl at the rear of the group,
They've fallen back, McCall said. It's dead quiet out there. That can mean only one thing.
I'm a medic, not a soldier, McCall. What does it mean?
McCall sighed as Dawden attended to the splinter wounds in his face. They've failed with a physical assault. They're drawing back so they can bring up artillery. Dawden nodded.
Get below, into the Undercroft, all of you. Foskin, Lesp will help you cook up some food for all. Do it. Artillery or not, I want everyone sustained.
The men filed away towards the steps into the cellar. Dawden was alone again in the hall. Corbeck entered, covered in blood and fire soot. He dropped Brosten's empty flamer onto one cot and threw Tamard's spent lasgun the other way.
Time's trickling away, Doc, he said. We held them, Feth, but we held them. But they're going to hammer us now. I scoped movement over the fens, big guns being wheeled into place. An hour, if we're lucky, and then they'll level us from a distance.
Colum, I thank you for all you and the men have done tonight. I hope it was worth it.
It's always worth it, Doc.
So what do we do now? Bury ourselves in the cellar.
Corbeck shrugged.
That won't save us from their shells.
Don't know about you, but I'm going to do the only thing I can think of in a time like this.
Which is?
Pray to the Emperor. McCall said there was an old shrine out back of this place. Prayers are all we have left. Together, Corbeck and Dawden pulled their way through a litter of rubble and debris and broken furniture into the little room at the back of the farmhouse. It had lost its roof, and the stars twinkled above them. Corbeck had brought a lamp. He played its light over the rear walls, picking up the flaking painted image on the ornamental screen McCall had mentioned. It showed the Divine Emperor subduing the heretics, and smaller figures of a man, a woman, and three small children, shown in obeisance to the central figure of the God Emperor of Man.
There's an inscription here,
Dawden said, scraping the dirt away from the wall with his cuff pulled up over the ball of his hand.
A pig? What is this?
Corbeck raised the lamp and read off the inscription.
Here's irony for you, Doc. This was a trophy world. A new Tanith. The master of this hall was a Farren's cloaker of the Imperial Guard. Hogskull Regiment. The Hogskulls won this world during the first advance into the Sabbat 190 years ago. Winning it, they were awarded settlement rights. Cloaker was a corporal in the guard, and he took his rights gladly. Settled here, made a family, raised swine in honor of the mascot beast of his old regiment. His kin have honored that ever since.
Corbeck faltered, something like sadness in his eyes.
Feth, to get there, to win it, to take the trophy world. And still it comes down to this?
Not for all. How many trophy worlds are there out there where the soldiers of the guard have retired and lived out their days?
I don't know. This is all too real. To fight for your lifetime, get the prize you wanted. And then this.
Corbeck and Dawden sank down together in the debris-strewn chapel. You asked me why I stayed with you, Doc. I'll tell you now, as we're dead, and we have nothing to live for. With that last remark, Corbeck flung his hand towards the Reredos's inscription.
Well?
You were the doctor for Prize County for 20 years.
27. And Beldane.
Corbeck nodded.
I was raised in Prize. My family were woodworkers there. I was born out of wedlock, and so I took my father's name, when I knew him. My mother now. I was a difficult birth.
Dawden stiffened, knowing somehow what must come next.
She'd have died in labor, had it not been for the young medic who charged out in the night and saw to her. Landa Merrock. Remember her?
She would have died if I hadn't.
Thank you, Dr. Dawden.
Dawden looked round at Corbeck in wonder.
I delivered you. Feth. Fething Feth. Am I that old?
They laughed together until they were choking, and until the thump of artillery began, blasting the quiet of the night away. The Imperial Guard drove the enemy back with their shelling. Angaunt was on the foremost half-track as they ploughed back into the fenlands in the early light of dawn. They caught the enemy almost unawares, and were blasting the chaos artillery and infantry even as the enemy wheeled their own blasphemous guns around into position in the dark.
The farmhouse and its shattered defence of horseshoe fences was almost unrecognisable. Mud, burnt flakboard, and shattered corpses lay piled amidst the devastated ruins. He ordered the vehicle to stop, and it spun wheels on the Fenland muck as it slid to a halt. Trooper Less was on duty at the gateway. He saluted the Colonel Commissar as he passed in. Dawdon and Corbeck were waiting for him in the littered yard.
"Medical evac is coming," Gaunt told them. "We'll get the Volpone wounded out of here."
"And our own, too?"
Dawdon asked, thinking of Tremard and McColl's lacerated face. "All of the wounded.
So, you've had an adventure out here, it seems."
"Nothing to speak of, sir," Corbeck said. Gaunt nodded and moved off into the manor house ruin. Corbeck turned to Dawdon and showed him the pig's tooth he had clutched in his hand.
"I won't forget this," he said. "It may not have worked here on Nacedon for this guardsman, but by this tooth, I'll trust it will work for us ghosts. A trophy world, brighter and better than you can imagine."
Dawdon's hand held a pig tooth too, marked the Emperor.
"I trust you to do that, Colum."
"Do it.
Doctor's orders."
Swing, address, stab, return. Swing, address, stab, return. In the shade of the cycads at the edge of the Tanith encampment on Monthax, Trooper Caffran was practicing bayonet discipline. Stripped to the waist, his powerful young shoulders glistening with sweat, he whirled his lasgun in time to his rhythmic chant, snapping it round, clutching it horizontally, lunging forward and killing the bole of one of the trees over and again. After each strike, he tugged it free with effort and repeated the drill. The trunk was slashed and puckered, oozing orange sap from the wounds left by his nimble work.
"Good skill," Gaunt said from behind him.
Caffran snapped around, realizing he was being watched. He shook sweat from his brow and began a salute.
"At ease," Gaunt said. "I'm just walking the lines. Everything all right with you? The men in your platoon?"
Caffran felt tongue-tied, as he always did when Gaunt addressed him directly. He still, after all this time, had mixed feelings about the Commissar who had both saved them and made them ghosts in the same action.
"We're all waiting for the word," he said at last. "Etching for action. This waiting."
"It's the worst part, I know." Gaunt sat down on a nearby log.
"Until the killing starts and you realize the waiting wasn't all that bad after all."
Caffran caught the smile in Gaunt's eyes and grinned as well, unable to stop himself. Gaunt was pleased. He was very aware of the stiffness Caffran always manifested around him. A good soldier, one of the youngest, but so very nearly one of Rawn's malcontents.
"Go again," Gaunt suggested.
Self-consciously, Caffran turned and repeated his drill. Swing, address, stab, return. It took a moment to pull his blade free from the thick bark.
"Slide it," Gaunt said. "It'll come out easier if you slide it laterally before pulling."
Caffran did so. It was true. Gaunt got up, moving on with his circuit.
"Not long now, Caffran," Gaunt said as he moved away.
Caffran sighed. "No, not long. Not long before the frenzy and the madness would start. Swing, address, stab, slide, return. Swing, address, stab, slide, return." Part 9. A Simple Plan. Engines screaming, the Imperial troop carriers fell upon the ocean world Sapientia. Like swarms of fat black beetles shrilling in over the edges of a pond, they assaulted the Bay of Balana. Their combined downdrafts boiled the choppy surface water into foam mist, an embankment of steam 3 kilometers long and 200 meters high that stormed forward across the beach rocks and blinded the island's outer defenses. It entirely hid the merciless wall of solid water driven up under the spray by the concussive force, and this tidal wave exploded across the western seafall emplacements of Osprey Island 20 seconds after the steam cloud choked them. Rock and metal and flesh were pulverized, blasted into the air, then sucked back into the basin of the bay as pressures equalized and hydraulic action righted itself. A spume haze hung over the island, clogging the beaches and masking the final slow approach of the gargantuan troopships. The heavy emplacements higher on the cliffs of Osprey spat fierce salvos down into the mist, or up into the striated clouds where further formations of troopships were beginning their final approaches to the island shore. The fire from the batteries, blue and flickering, danced like luminous damselflies amongst the beetle-like ships. Some craft burst as they were touched and burned, some dropped, bleeding smoke and trailing lines of debris. The 20 kilometers of Osprey Island was only partly rock. It was, in point of fact, a cluster of islets, linked as one by the massive industrial fortification built up upon the shoulders of submarine mountains. Behind ocean-blocking walls of stone 100 meters thick, pump structures, drill towers, flame-belching waste stacks and pylons rose against the sky. The primary target, the great refinery hive of Osprey Island 1. Red hazard lights flashed, and hooters started their deafening caterwaul as the jaw-hatch locks of troopship Lambda disengaged with a massive leaden thump. Dim light began to pour in from outside as the jaw sections hinged open. Cafran, tensed tight and ready, knew they were assaulting a sea-bound target, and that the way in for the infantry was up the beach. That was the plan. But as the troop hatch opened, he believed for a moment they had come in too low, and it was translucent torrents of water that were spurting into the dispersal deck. He gulped in his breath, held it, but it was only steam and pale light that rushed over him. The yells of men, of boots racing on metal decking, and of the hooters were overwhelming. With 50 others, lasguns raised, he charged out of the hatch mouth. For a second, on the ramp, the dispersal deck noises were swamped by the greater volume of the thundering dropships all around. Cafran could see nothing beyond the men closest to him and the solid atmosphere of mist and smoke. He could smell salt and ozone, oil and thermite. Then nothing. Rushing silence, roaring dullness, a coldness all over him, enveloping him, dark grey blurs in his eyes. He was underwater, floundering in the chilly, muffled dark of the sea, writhing black bodies struggling and flailing around him, each one bejeweled with trapped baubles of silver air. The troopship had come up short of the beach slope, and all the men dropping blind off the ramp were falling into 30 meters of ocean, where the island shelved steeply away. Cafran couldn't swim. He'd been born and raised in a forest 1,000 kilometers from any open water. He'd never seen the ocean, any ocean, though he'd heard others, like the medic fisherman Lesp, speak of it. He was going to do the last thing he had ever expected to do. Drown. Momentarily, he realized he had not yet released the deep breath he had instinctively sealed into his lungs when he thought the dispersal deck was going to flood, and he almost laughed, almost releasing the air. Instead, he held on to it, felt it burning and exhausting inside him, as he rose slowly to what seemed the surface. It saved his life, where others had gone screaming and exhaling off the ramp. Sinking, blundering, black shapes thrashed around him. Tanith combat dress, dark as dry blood, faces pale like phantoms or ghouls. A body sank beside him, arms frozen in claws, mouth open to emit a dribble of bubbles, eyes glazed. Cafran kicked upwards again. Something struck him stunningly hard on the back of the neck, and he lost his precious saved breath in a blurt of silvery air pebbles. Men were still coming off the ramp end above, falling on those ghosts now coming up from below. A boot had hit him. The man it belonged to was inverted in the water behind him, panicking, dying. Cafran kicked away, trying to rise and not breathe in to ease his emptied, screaming lungs. He saw men explode into the grey, dreamy world from above, fighting the water as they hit and sank. But that at least told him the surface was only a few meters away. The man who had kicked him on his way down had become entangled with another by the slings of their lasguns. One of them fired his lasgun in desperation, twice, three times. The water boiled around each slicing minnow of orange light. Cafran's ears throbbed as they heard the fizzing report of the underwater shots. One of the las rounds punctured a drifting corpse nearby. Another punched through the leg of a desperate swimmer next to Cafran. Blood fogged the water. Cafran heard the distant voices of his ancestors in his ears, muffled by pressure and fluid and distance and time. He surfaced in a gasping explosion, retching, treading water, blood streaming from his nose. He looked around to see ghosts surfacing all around, kicking towards the shore or just panicking. Some were floating in the surge, lifeless, already lost. Noise rushed back to him, the momentous noise of combat, now unfiltered by the deadness of the sea. Screaming, the wicker of lasguns, the roar of troopship downwash. He could smell blood, water, and smoke, but was thankful because that meant he was breathing. Behind him, las rounds punched up out of the water into the fog as other unfortunates lost their grip on everything but their triggers as they drowned. Kafran paddled forward, hacking up each and every slop of seawater he accidentally swallowed. The pall of smoke and fog cut visibility at the surface to 10 meters. For a moment, he heard the voices of his ancestors again, then realized that that wasn't what he'd heard at all. It was his micro-bead intercom, crackling with staccato traffic, screeching into his earplug. Underwater, it had been the tinny whisper of ghosts. Kafran felt gravel or sand under his boots, a slope. He felt weight and momentum return to him as he churned up through shallower and still shallower water, falling twice and choking. Bolt rounds and las fire whipped and stitched the breakers around him, cutting down the ghost beaching next to him. The man fell face down, his body lifted and pulled back again by the choppy waves. Kafran fell again as a las round scorched across the top of his left shoulder, dropping him to his knees. His shins scraped on the stony gravel, shredding his fatigue pants from the knee down. He felt his lasgun grow heavier and flop away. The shot had cut his gun strap across the shoulder. Hands pulled him up as he grabbed hold of his weapon. Kafran! It was Domo, the squad's sweeper. He was laden down with the heavy backpack of the sweeper unit and its long-handled sensor broom. Domo had lost his eyes, and almost his life, in that final push on Menazoid Epsilon 6 months before. They had been there together for that fatal time, in the thick of it, as they were here. Domo's metal-irised artificial implants shuddered and whined as they adjusted to look down at Kafran. The sweeper's cybernetic implants looked like truncated binocular scopes crudely sutured into the scar tissue of his eye sockets. "We can make the beach!" Domo yelled, pulling the young trooper to his feet. They ran, blundering through the breakers. Others charged or staggered in with them, a ragged line of ghosts making landfall on the fog-washed shore, some falling over submerged barricade crosses or entangling themselves on rolls of rusting razor wire. The firestorm fell amongst them, and some dropped silently, or screaming, or in minced pieces. Now, the flinty shingle slope of the beach. They crashed up it, pebbles flying from each footfall. 20 meters up, they ducked below the lichen-fronded line of an old wooden groin, black as tar. Lasfire slammed into its weighty bulk.
"What's the plan? What have we got?"
Kafran yelled.
"Nothing. Visibility is low. Heavy resistance from up there."
Domo pointed up into the spray fog at something only his augmented vision could resolve, and then only barely. Two more bodies flung themselves down next to them, then a third. Trooper McKendrick with his flamer. Trooper Chilam, missing an ear and yowling like a cat as he dabbed his salty hand at the bloody hunk of cartilage on the side of his head. And then Sergeant Vahl. Vahl was a popular officer amongst the ghosts. Young, field-promoted from the rank of trooper, a wise-cracking, hard-nosed bastard, refreshingly lacking all the airs and graces of the officer class. He'd lost his shoulder on Fortis Binary, and his black tunic bulged over the cybernetic joint the medics had given him. It was clear to Kafran that the sergeant was in some pain. Vahl cursed and struggled with his artificial shoulder. Seawater had soaked into the shoulder joint, shorting out servos and fusing linkages. His arm was dead and useless, but still the raw neural connections transmitted flickers of shorting electrical failure to his brain. Domo had been lucky. His ocular units had been sealed into his skull enough to prevent such damage, though Kafran wondered how long it would take the insidious touch of seawater corrosion to blind the man. With McKendrick's help, Kafran stripped off Vahl's tunic and unscrewed the bolts on the small inspection plate in Vahl's metal shoulder blade. With the point of his Tanith dagger, McKendrick prized out the flat battery cells revealed there, cutting the electrical relay which governed the limb. Vahl sighed as his arm went dead and Kafran strapped it up, tight against the sergeant's body. It was a desperate gesture. Without the booster relay of the cells, not only all neural control, but all life support would be cut from the organic parts of Vahl's repaired arm. He needed proper help, or within an hour or two, his now lifeless arm would begin to decay and perish. For now, though, the sergeant was grateful. He scrambled over, supporting himself on his one good hand, and took a look over the cover line. Along the beach, under the downpour of fire, men were coming ashore. Most were dying. Some were making it to cover.
"Where in Feth's name is the armor?" Val wailed. "They should have led the assault and opened this beach up."
Cafran scoped around and saw heavy basilisk tanks half submerged, struggling up the beach 100 meters away. They were in too deep, drowning like beached whales, squirming and coughing exhaust smoke as their engines flooded and died.
"The troopships dropped us short," he said to Val.
Val looked where Cafran pointed.
"They've drowned the front end of this fething assault," he bellowed.
"They were blind. The spray," Cafran began.
"Feth them for not doing their job," Val spat.
A whinnying bolt round ricocheted off the top of the groin's solid woodwork and took Chilam straight in the face, exploding his head. He flew back onto the shingle, full length.
"We have to advance. We have to," Val yelled.
Microbead chatter, discordant and contradictory, rasped in their ears.
"There's no going forward," Domor said quietly.
The spume of the spray mist was receding, and now they could see what he saw. The vast white curtain wall of Osprey Island's sea defences rose ahead of them, almost a kilometre high. Apart from some stray scorch marks, it was unblemished. The basilisks had been meant to flatten it and break through for the infantry, but the wall still stood, impassive, cold, like a denial of any possible future. Val cursed. Cafran heard the protesting wail first. He looked back out to sea, then grabbed Domor and Val and threw them flat into the painful jumble of the shingle. McKendrick dived down too. A troopship, one of the great fat beetles, on fire from end to end, was coming in low, half sidelong, nose down, spilling burning fuel in shreds of fuselage. It was huge, blocking out the sky, 600 tons of dying metal, keening in towards the beach, over their heads. Its jaw hatches were still closed. "Men are cooking in there," Cafran thought, wondering which regiment, and then, as it came down on top of his head, his thoughts gutted out like a candle flame in a hurricane. McKendrick shook him awake. Cafran stirred and woke up into the roar of the assault.
"How long have I been out?"
"Less than a minute,"
McKendrick said. Cafran struggled up out of the shingle. It had felt like hours, like all his fatigue and pain had overwhelmed him and sent him to sleep.
"What happened?" he gasped. "I thought for Feth we were dead then."
McKendrick pointed. At first there was little to see. The white steam and mist had become fouled with black smoke, and the ashy curls of it, thick with glowing cinders, enveloped the beach. Then Cafran made out more. The stricken troopship had slammed over them, coming to rest at the head of the beach where the last few seconds of its crash flight had been broken by the fortified seawall of Osprey Island. The impact had blown the wall in. For 600 meters, its immeasurably old and solid stone was fused and fractured. A blackened chasm had opened into the heart of the refinery. The men aboard the troopship had bought a way into the target with their lives as surely as if they had fought their way up the beach. Cafran gathered scattered items which had split from his burst pack and recovered his fallen lasgun. McKendrick was changing las cells. A short way off, Val and Domor were making ready, and small groups of ghosts in foxholes along the beach were also preparing to make use of this new way in. Enemy fire still strafed down from the wall, though it was thinner now, such a chunk of the wall had gone. The incoming troopships, still roaring and settling over the tide line behind them, were jockeying into this blind spot to avoid the tracking fire from the main batteries on the cliffs. Cafran heard thunder and turned to see 4 basilisks hoving up the beach, properly delivered, moving past them into the breach and tracking to fire. They sizzled up wet stone flecks as they rolled, cranking their huge, decorated bulks up and over the groins. Cafran recognized the markings. Ketsox, the 17th Armored Regiment, the so-called Serpents, who had been gulled into slaughtering them back on Voltimand. With Val, Domor, McKendrick, and several others, Cafran moved in towards the breach, running over stone litter and smouldering fragments of blackened mechanicals, the last remnants of the troopship. Stray las shots winged down at them, and stubber rounds rattled with a curious clack-clack sound off the stone facings to their left. Entering the chasm in the wall, Kafran passed into deep shadow. Ahead, 100 meters down the V-shaped channel blasted by the crash, a dimness loomed. He felt a sense of pride. They would be the first, the ghosts would be the first, to break through the stalwart defenses of the target. He was close to the far end now, stumbling with the others through the shadow, picking his way around mangled hull fragments. Ahead, the dimness was becoming a forest of steel and iron, the refinery itself. Gaunt had been precise in his briefing. The fleet could have vaporized Oscre Island from orbit, but it was too valuable. That meant a land assault to retake it from the legions of chaos. The vile host here called themselves the Kith, some high-fermented subcult of Khorne. Kafran had blanked on some of the briefing's complexities, partly because it was alien gibberish to him, and partly because the gibberish made him feel ill. He didn't want to listen to the details concerning the filth they were going up against. The Kith. That was all he focused on. The Kith were the subhuman vermin he was here to eradicate. Their leader was a monster called Sholan Skara. Fragments of the Chaos Armada stopped at Balhaut had run to Sapientia for shelter, and their leaders had conjoined with a Chaos cult already thriving in the underclass of the vast hive to overthrow Imperial rule and seize the fuel oil and Promethium wells. Colonel Commissar Gaunt had spoken long and passionately about the Kith in his briefing. Kafran knew Gaunt had been part of the great Balhaut